22. It is pertinent to point out here that, in conversation with the gardener Leonard Mantell in 1969, some of the technological information imparted by Isokhan chimes with Sorensen's description. For instance, Mantell learned that the propulsion system of the craft used by Khan's race included a cylindrical column that contained mercury, chapter 12, and in chapter 13 we learned that the W-56 aliens required mercury for many of their applications, including craft, the propulsion of which they revealed to several of their contacts as part of a technology transfer. George Adamski was the first to publish details of a central column inside smaller spacecraft, describing how a pillar about 2 feet thick extended downward from the very top of the dome to the center of the floor. Later I was told that this was the magnetic pole of the ship, by means of which they drew on nature's forces for propulsion purposes, but they did not explain how this was done. He did learn, however, that the top of the pole was positive while the bottom was negative. But, when necessary, his host explained, these poles can be reversed, and added that the central pillar served a double purpose, as a powerful telescope, with one end pointing up through the dome to view the sky, and the other pointing down through the floor to inspect the land below. 23. Vandenberg and Edwards Air Force Bases. In 1986, Peter Biagio Tresca, an aerospace engineer, was joint director of Lawrence Engineering and Supply Incorporated, based in Burbank. Tresca's daughter Teresa, who worked for her father at the time, recalls seeing blueprints on her father's desk that depicted what looked like a type of flying saucer. Apparently the government had made them, she told me. I wanted to take the blueprints and show them to my teacher at college, but they weren't allowed out of the office. My father used to take me to air shows, and in August or September 1988 he took me to a restricted show at Vandenberg, and I saw the demonstration of a flying saucer, like the one on the blueprints. I was busy watching a display of jets when it suddenly came in from the left, came in front of us, and then took off again. I didn't hear it approaching. 24. Her husband, British UFO researcher Philip Waterhouse, fills in further details. She said the craft approached from near some hangars and hovered silently at about 10 feet, apart from a relatively high-pitched humming noise. Then after about 5 minutes the craft pitched up and shot off into the sky to the right of where they were standing. There were only about 20 people, including her father and herself, who were witness to this event. She said the craft was about 20 or 25 feet wide and about 10 feet high. What is interesting about her description is the fact that the bottom was bowed upwards, which is fairly uncommon, and the craft appeared all in one piece, though it seemed to be sectioned in a circular way, with a dome on top. It was silver-colored all over, apart from the indented parts, which could have been shadows. Teresa's sketches of the side, top, and bottom of the craft, toward the end of the following summer, 1989. Teresa accompanied her father to Edwards Air Force Base to attend another restricted air show. The same number of people was present. She saw more of the conventional stealth-type aircraft, and what appeared to be the same black triangle. The saucer-shaped craft did not make an appearance. What was the level of security? I pressed her. Did you need any special access? My dad did, she replied. I would ask him questions, but he never really told me anything. He was really hush-hush about it all. And it was just a relatively small number of people at these two air shows? Yes. I would say about 15 or so, mostly men. Apart from my father, there were other bigwigs from Lawrence Engineering, such as Fletcher Seymour, Ray Barker, Ray and Mary Smith. Of course, there was also a lot of military there. But weren't they concerned? I asked, incredulously. You were just with your father, and you were let in on it, so to speak. I think my dad was questioned about it because he was walked off. They took him off somewhere and questioned him, because that was the last time that I was able to go to a show. And after that, it was like everything was hush-hush. 26. Prior to marrying Philip, Teresa worked for 5 years as a sheriff for the Santa Clarita, California, Sheriff's Department. I find her testimony compelling, and it provides corroborative evidence for the observations reported by the previous witnesses. Los Alamos, the demonstration of a much smaller craft was described for me by Gregory Millsworth, a former U.S. Army lieutenant colonel and platoon commander who served in Vietnam. In Washington, D.C., in February 1994, he told me that 18 months previously, he had been working as a sound man for a British Broadcasting Corporation, BBC, documentary on the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI. While filming at Los Alamos National Laboratory, he witnessed the demonstration of a 4-foot diameter disc, radio-controlled via a joystick in a metal-lined laboratory. As foreign nationals, British participants were not allowed in, and Millsworth himself was threatened if he tried to film anything. California bases. I have been reading recently about all the alleged underground alien labs and facilities and took particular interest in a rumor purporting an underground base of this kind to be located in the Lancaster, Palmdale area near the Tehachapi Mountains, begins a narrative from Alex R., a woman who together with her friend Anne-Marie had a somewhat disturbing experience in the early 1980s. Anne-Marie had purchased some undeveloped land in that area. She herself, however, had not yet seen it. Her husband Ken had bought the property and confirmed that it was in an ideal location, then deeded it over to her after they divorced, giving her a rough map with some landmarks to assist her in locating it. We drove the nearly 2 hours to Lancaster, Palmdale and began our search. The map was not much help, however, because it had been made when the area was still undeveloped, and most of the natural landmarks were gone, removed to make room for houses. Every time we found what looked like a road which would take us somewhere, it turned into a dead end. The area we were in was now full of cul-de-sacs for the housing development that would soon be built on it. After about 2.5 hours of driving, we stopped for a cool drink. We got back on the main highway and decided to look for dirt roads in the hope that the land was still undeveloped and that we had missed it. At last, a broad, well-kept dirt road appeared. At first we thought it might be the entrance to someone's farm or ranch, but, since there wasn't a mailbox, we decided to proceed. After about half a mile, something odd happened. The dirt road became a wide, beautifully paved asphalt road, with a single white dividing line. We were astounded at this but were glad, as the dirt road was taking its toll on Anne-Marie's car. We had driven about 2 miles when, up ahead, we saw what looked like a dust storm coming out of the mountains. Anne-Marie slowed down, and we watched. It was not a storm but a vehicle, a car, coming toward us at full speed. "Let's get out of here," said. "I don't think that would be a good idea," said Anne-Marie. She came to a complete stop, right in the middle of the road. "Are you crazy?" I said. "Stay calm and let me do the talking," she said. The car, a drab olive-green late-model sedan, was, by now, up on the road, still driving full speed. They were heading directly for us. I was afraid that they would not stop in time and would hit us. The car stopped, brakes screeching, within inches of us, and 2 men got out. A third man remained in the car. They were young men, in their mid-30s, dressed in pale blue coveralls, no nameplates or insignias, and baseball caps. One had sandy colored hair, the other was white blonde. The third man was in the front seat of the car, talking on the radio microphone. All wore wraparound sunglasses. Somehow, I knew that we might be in terrible trouble and that we were somewhere we didn't belong. The sandy-haired man came up to the driver's side of the car, the blonde one was on my side, the passenger side. He kept his right hand in his pocket at all times. I wondered if he was carrying a gun. "Good afternoon, ladies," said Sandy Hare. "Where are you going?" Anne-Marie showed him the map. "We're trying to find my property," she said. "Can you help us?" He studied the map. "You haven't been here for a while, have you?" he said. "All of these places on the map have been removed or destroyed." He looked at the map again. "This place looks like it might be on the other side of town. Why don't you look there?" He was extremely polite, smiling all the while he spoke, yet he terrified me and Anne-Marie. The blonde man never spoke, nor did he smile or look at me. The third man remained on the radio. "We'll be happy to escort you ladies back to the main road." Though it sounded like a polite suggestion, it was actually an order to leave now. Anne-Marie said nothing, merely backed up slowly and drove back, still slowly, to our place of entrance into this forbidden area. The men and their car stayed close behind us and followed us for several miles. Anne-Marie and I did not speak during this time. I think we were too scared. Then, instead of going back to the main part of the city, she took the next freeway on a ramp and headed back home. I noticed that she kept looking in her rearview mirror. "Someone is following us," she said. I was too frightened to turn around, so I lowered my sun visor and looked in the vanity mirror. There, a few car lengths behind us, was another late model sedan, medium blue in color, being driven by a man in a green coverall, wearing a cap and wraparound sunglasses. His two companions were dressed the same way. "They probably want to make sure that we go back home and don't try to come back," said Anne-Marie. Kent told me that he had heard about the government using parts of that area for secret experiments, she said. The car followed the ladies until they were halfway home, then began to back off and eventually disappeared. On arriving home, Anne-Marie dropped Alex off. They agreed to meet later for dinner at a local restaurant. We were now curious about what had happened and wondered if we should go back or if we would be able to find the road again. We lived in the San Fernando Valley and were not at all familiar with the Antelope Valley area. We then got further into our mutual interest in UFOs, and jokingly considered the possibility that the men we had seen were really aliens. We left the restaurant at about 10:30. The restaurant is situated in a very busy traffic area and is also near a freeway and a very well-known and very busy motor hotel. There is constant noise and traffic at all hours. It is never quiet there. However, this night, things were to be different. When we came out of the restaurant, the street was deserted. This was on a Saturday night, one of the busiest nights of the week for this restaurant. There were no cars going by, no people, no sounds of traffic. In fact, there was no sound of any kind. 27 When Anne-Marie and I spoke to each other, our voices sounded hollow, far away. Neither of the ladies had ever seen it so quiet. Then, as if on command, Alex reported, we both looked up. There, at a level just over our heads, across the street, was a spacecraft. We could not see the craft itself very clearly, but it was outlined by white lights that ran all around it. It was the shape of an elongated triangle. It remained in its position for what seemed a few minutes. Then it moved away. Suddenly, as if someone had turned up the volume on a TV set, all the normal sounds returned. We walked to our cars and Anne-Marie checked her watch. "Oh, my God," she said. "What time do you have?" I looked at my watch and was stunned. It was 12:35 a.m. We had been looking at the spacecraft for 2 hours and 5 minutes. That was the final straw and all the fright we wanted to have for one day. We agreed never to go out to look for that forbidden area, and Anne-Marie sold her property soon after this incident. There may be more than just rumors about what is going on in the Tehachapi Mountains. 28 Tom Keller, who features in Chapter 9, has worked for British Aerospace, Douglas Aircraft, and NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. In the Total Novice's Guide to UFOs, he writes extensively about Antelope Valley, described as a hotbed for the aerospace industry. "When I lived there," he reports, "Lockheed Martin, Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, and Northrop Grumman all had multiple facilities there." He mentions a base at the northwest end of the Antelope Valley and the foothills of the Tehachapi Mountains, known as the Anthill, and another area known as the Tijan RCS, Radar Cross-Section, facility. Both are owned by Northrop Grumman. Another site is the Hellendale Avionics facility, owned by Lockheed Martin Skunk Works. Observations of flying discs and other unusual craft have been observed periodically over the years. 29. Researcher Bill Hamilton reports the observation in the Antelope Valley in October 1988 by two witnesses known to him of a large boomerang-shaped craft, estimated to be over 600 feet in span, traveling very slowly. A second and identical large object joined behind the first one, he reports in his book, Cosmic Top Secret. The trailing boomerang was followed by approximately 15 to 20 disc-shaped objects in formation. Two additional witnesses saw the boomerangs pass over the valley from a side view to the east, and these were also sighted in Fresno later that same evening. The objects rose in altitude to clear the Tehachapi Mountains to the north, flying directly over the secret Northrop and Hill facility. 30. In 1988, Hamilton learned from a Northrop source that during the early era, a disc obtained from aliens via an exchange program had been sequestered underground at Edwards AFB. He also learned from several other sources that construction of underground facilities at the base began in the 1950s, and that a disc or discs had been stored in a hangar at the North Base or underground. 31. Project Aquarius, William J. Porlek, a former U.S. Air Force computer operations and programming specialist with numerous credentials in security technologies and access control systems, who died in May 2007, also confirmed the alien technology transfer. "I would say this is international in scope," he told Stephen Greer of the Disclosure Project. During an interview that Porlek had specified not be released until December 2010, "If you look at what layers of influence we have here, either at government or corporate level, I would say that at the corporate level we have to look primarily first. If you're talking about new propulsion technologies, we would first only look to the aerospace industry. I've had deep discussions with some people over a long period of time who, either they or their fathers, had worked for various aerospace companies and had been directly involved with the research as far back as the early 1950s on into the 1960s. And then by the 1970s they felt they had overcome most of the problems in reverse engineering technologies from what, interestingly enough, they never call them UFOs, they call them AVCs, alien visitation craft." 32. A trusted source of mine, the same aerospace journalist who supplied me with a great deal of information on these matters for inclusion in Unearthly Disclosure, has hinted that in the 1980s a few aerospace companies, principally Lockheed and Northrop, had established underground plants inside the Tehachapi Mountains which produced top-secret, high-tech flying machines, allegedly produced by the Air Force's Project Aquarius in conjunction with aerospace and electronics companies. The huge amounts of money involved were distributed and sequestered in the black budget. This exchange program purportedly involved a species of the so-called Grays aliens who claim to have first come to Earth just after World War II and began establishing many underground and undersea bases around the world. These were located in areas such as Alaska, Australia, the Caribbean Sea, south of the Florida Keys, the Manzano Mountains near the nuclear weapons storage area at Kirtland Air Force Base, New Mexico, and the Monongahela National Forest in West Virginia. Several other bases were located around the world, mainly in Asia. "From the information made available to me, I have deduced that the largest undersea base was probably located in the Milwaukee Seamounts, 32 degrees 46 latitude, 171 degrees 91 longitude, in the Pacific Ocean some 1,700 miles west-northwest of Honolulu. 33. By 1973, they had come to stay. Highly telepathic, the beings were about 4.5 feet tall, featuring large heads, large almond-shaped black eyes, vestigial mouths, noses, and ears, and very thin hands with no thumbs. The alien craft's propulsion systems interacted with the magnetic fields existing throughout space and around celestial bodies, they claimed. Enormously powerful electrical charges were generated in tube-like toruses ranging around the insides of the hulls. The toruses were superconductors, made of materials not found on Earth. They were non-resistant to electric current, allowing the current to run free, and forever. Magnets inside the tubes converted the current into plasma jets. Each ship had several such systems to provide energy for different purposes. The buildup of magnetic fields around the ships, when their propulsion systems powered up, sometimes made them glow. Air Force development of its own flying discs owed to their having studied recovered alien craft, a number of which had been brought down by the military. Although it was ascertained that the plasma field surrounding the craft shielded it from guided missiles, oddly enough bullets, shells, and cannon fire could cause severe damage and/or bring down such a craft, as another source confirmed for me, at least in the early days. As Colonel Philip J. Gosso states, in later years hostile alien craft could be brought down by advanced particle beam weapons, such as those fired from Blue Gemini satellites, as part of the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI. 33. The discs reverse-engineered by the USAF were technologically inferior to those of the extraterrestrials, I learned. Nonetheless, the aliens acknowledged that they had underestimated us in this regard and were said to have been impressed. Design and production was said to be almost totally automated. One craft, apparently a two-seater, was described as appearing like two soup bowls fastened together rim to rim, seamless, with no sign of windows and three slender landing legs which retracted into slots. Entrance was via a hatch under the hull. Propulsion was also said to involve plasma. Indeed, it has been described as a plasma-propelled magneto-hydro-soft-dynamic vehicle, and in water a magneto-soft-hydro-soft-dynamic vehicle. 30 for a vertical tube, some 3 feet in diameter, extended from the top of the cabin down through the floor. A superconductor torus of hot plasma circled the horizontal rim of the inner and outer hulls, generating a powerful propulsion field that interacted with Earth's ambient magnetic field, propelling the craft. Another hot plasma supersoft-conductor torus circled the craft vertically. The craft's CPU, central processing unit, was alleged to make billions of calculations per second, manipulating the plasma flow to counter G-forces. The American pilots wore special helmets that afforded enhanced reality for use in the plasma environment. Each helmet is unique to the pilot who wears it, reading his brain's electromagnetic signature. The craft also utilized biocomputers. Viewing ports in the hull appeared only when required. Weaponry consisted of a very powerful beam that focused a mixture of photons and free electrons onto the target. I do not know how much of this information is factual. But based on my acquaintance with the source for many years, I feel that, even allowing for disinformation, it is substantially true. Italian Liaison, in Chapter 13, I detailed some of the wealth of information provided for me by Professor Stefano Breccia regarding the propulsion systems of the Amicizia, W-56, craft. On one occasion, he was given the opportunity of a flight in a craft, together with his German engineer friend Hans. No aliens were on board, but both the craft and its occupants were monitored at all times. Stefano told me that a safety precaution involved jumping on board with both feet, presumably to avoid an electric shock, as explained in Chapter 13. Hans took the controls, while Stefano, a licensed pilot of conventional aircraft, was content to make calculations relating to coordinates, etc., on his calculator. I did not want to pilot the craft, he told me frankly, but I asked the W-56S to show me the coordinates. The control unit, on a ledge inside the flange, was most interesting, partly owing to its small size, about that of a PC keyboard. It had virtual images, like modern mobiles, but no keypads. Today's mobile phones would not work in a craft. Incidentally, I used my Olivetti 22 typewriter to make notes. The floor was of metal but rather soft and looked like plastic. Light appeared to be generated from nowhere, it's the air that's lit. Shadows go in the opposite direction from what you would suppose. There were no portholes, but the metal of the craft could be made transparent, enabling one to see either outside or inside. The seats weren't very comfortable, owing to a triangular-shaped back. And there was a strange instrument that gave off different colors to different portions of air inside the cabin. It's used for giving an idea of electrical, magnetic and gravitational fields inside, a global measure so you can decide which color should be attributed to a particular thing. The trip was from Pescara to Moscow, Cairo, then back to Pescara, and the computer showed geographic coordinates. We found out that the craft did not travel in a straight line to its destination, but in a curve, which we thought strange. We flew at a very high altitude and at a speed of 6 to 7,000 kilometers per hour. There was no sensation of movement. Actually, it wasn't so interesting. I find it more exciting in ordinary planes. 35. This may seem somewhat blasé, but less so if we take into consideration the many years Stefano spent in close proximity to both the aliens and their craft. Stefano gave me additional details pertaining to the piloting of their craft, which bears comparison with data provided by the previous source. One could just touch certain lighted areas, which today we would call diodes, on a panel in front of the seat, which at all times presented one with the only available option in that specific situation. Then it would change, depending. You could choose four different possibilities for going from one place to another. 1. Limiting the amount of energy dissipated. 2. When emphasis is on the duration of travel. 3. When the pilot decides what to do at each moment, or manual override. 4. Totally remote control. For example, if the craft comes up against an obstacle, such as a mountain, say, the obstacle, or part thereof, is destroyed. When the computer is involved, it ensures that such obstacles are avoided. For example, when some Italian military pilots were being trained by the W-56 to pilot their scout craft, at a certain point south of Calabria they detected a ship which they weren't sure of, 16 kilometers away at a bearing of 234 degrees. The pilots decided to try to land on the ship, piloting normally without the computer. In doing so, they realized it was a naval ship of undetermined nationality. As they descended, the pilot encountered difficulties, so decided to engage the computer, which made the craft land on the ship. Of course, people on the ship, seeing this craft, reacted. And as they were military, they started firing at the craft. The pilots panicked, so, via remote control, the W-56 remedied the situation, pressing the fly-away option, in which the computer has control. So, when taking off from the ship, the craft destroyed part of the gun that was firing at them. Of course, the W-56S, overviewing the situation, reprimanded the pilots, as they had not been in any danger at all. The reason given by the AMICISIA for the transfer of their technology, Stefano revealed to me, was to have humans performing as well as they did, for example with regard to the CTR the Contrari, and other groups who opposed them. Furthermore, the W-56 group fully expected our pilots to defend themselves against the CTRs. These types of craft, Stefano emphasized, could not be captured or damaged by our weapons. How many of your country's pilots have flown these craft? I inquired. My guess, he responded, is that, among the AMICISIA group, 10 to 15 Italian pilots have been trained to fly them. 36. How many other countries have acquired alien technology? I do not know, but Paul Laviolette confirms that Canada and a number of European countries have been involved in top secret research programs since the 1950s, and Fred Steckling cited American-Soviet collaboration. Germany, I assume, would be high on the list, based on Hermann Oberth's testimony and that of others. There is also hearsay evidence, cited later, that the United States has shared much information with the United Kingdom. In any event, as time passes, it will become increasingly difficult to differentiate between theirs and ours and, perhaps more pertinently, between friend or foe. Chapter 16, Leviathans of the Skies. It was the late spring or early summer of 1956, probably May, when a huge disc-like object was seen by thousands off the northeast coast of Aberdeen, Scotland. One witness is my friend Ian Taylor, who gave me an extremely detailed account of this remarkable, yet now little known, event. At around 8:30, Ian was on his way to catch the bus to school, not that far from Aberdeen Airport. A keen plane spotter, as he scanned the mostly clear skies for contrails, he noticed what first appeared to be a balloon hovering in the direction of the city. The object seemed to be stationary, around the 1 o'clock position to the vertical, but I remember being aware of some gentle sideways movement coupled with similar vertical transitions too, he told me. By 10:30, at which point Ian was enjoying a break in the playground, the object still remained in the sky, causing him to wonder why, if it was a balloon, it hadn't drifted. It was still there at lunchtime. I noted it maintained a different elevation, and immediately became aware of two sets of contrails in the sky, heading up from the south in a northerly direction, toward the city.